The inside scoop on a heritage title with more than 300 years of history and a claim to be the original social media. A culture magazine that's very much still starting out on its own journey on newsstands, and a top executive from the tie-up between one of the leading global players in the sector and a Brazilian publishing house shares some of her trade secrets on the programme. That's all ahead today on a busy edition of The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tom Edwards. With a lineage traceable all the way back to a journal first published in 1709, Tatler might just be the original social media. More than three centuries later, the mix of glamour, fashion and politics remains compelling. Since February of this year, the magazine's had a new editor, Richard Denon, who's undertaken something of a spruce-up, bringing in new features to this most traditional of titles, whilst ensuring its signature irreverence and tongue-in-cheek approach endure. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco welcomed Richard to Midori House to talk about the changes Richard's introduced at Tatler.
The initial reaction, I guess, we could see in the circulation figures from my first issue going up. So I guess that's a vote of confidence. And September issue did really well too. So it's nice to see the figures and sometimes see that we're bucking a trend on newsstand.
And there's been some very smart changes there as well. For example, I loved the bystander, which used to be great.
Yeah, I moved the party pages to the front. Actually, it turns out, and I didn't actually know this fully when I did it, Tina Brown's in the 80s, her party pages were at the front as well. So it's not such a revolutionary thing to have done. But really what I did do was rename the whole front of book section Bystander. Bystander was actually a separate magazine that merged with Tatler in the 60s. So I really wanted to kind of grow that bit of the brand again. So I renamed the whole front of book Bystander and really to have the parties at the front and then followed by fashion pages and kind of trend pages and kind of social stories. I really wanted it to be, these are the people at the parties and then this is kind of shows you how to live like these people, how to dress like them, what they're reading, like what they're interested in. So that was the kind of idea behind it.
One of the things also I love about Tatler is kind of the humor. You know, it's a cheeky magazine, even when you compare it to other kind of lifestyle or fashion magazines. So do you think that remains important in the DNA of the brand?
Yeah, I think for me, wit comes across in a kind of more sophisticated way. I think wit, visual wit for Tatler is really important. I think our fashion is really glamorous, but also you can sometimes see kind of wit in some of the concepts. What I didn't want Tatler to be is have a kind of puerile, like boarding school sense of humour. I wanted it to be a very kind of sassy and sophisticated magazine as well. But I think, you know, an article about charity galas is always kind of be a bit tongue-in-cheek because, you know, it sort of comes with that world.
And the fashion is fabulous. I mean, I have December issue here with me. I have an amazing fashion shoot with Sabine Gatti.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, no,
fantastic clothes, I mean. So tell us a bit more. Did you change anything with the way the magazine approaches fashion?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I absolutely felt that it's not an impossible thing to have a magazine with good journalism and really good fashion. It was one of the things that I really wanted to do from the very beginning was kind of really get the fashion taken seriously. Obviously, Tatler, you know, we work with incredible partners and luxury fashion brands, and I really wanted it to be a kind of showcase for them as well. I think the amazing thing about Tatler is that it's really the one magazine which has the readers who can buy the stuff in it, which kind of makes things a little bit different. And I wanted to have incredible contributing fashion editors and stylish people to help me put together this glamorous thing. Yeah.
Talking about the reader of Tatler, you mentioned, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, they can buy all those things, but do you think perhaps you get a little bit of a young crowd or even international one as well, or the public is quintessentially British?
No, I think Tatler's got a very mixed kind of reader. Obviously, it's very popular in the UK. It is essentially a British magazine. I mean, I definitely want to grow it into something even more international. I mean, actually, you know, I know that it's very popular in America, it's very popular in the Middle East, it's very popular in Russia, where of course they have their own edition as well. But it is a mix. I think it all comes out of this British sensibility, but you'll see in my first few issues, I really wanted to have more international stories. You know, in the first issue about the princes in Riyadh being locked up in the Ritz-Carlton by the Crown Prince, you know, it doesn't have to be British stories, but it should be, you know, we live in this international world and we all read news stories from around the world. So I don't think Tatler should just be kind of focused on stuff in Britain.
And one of the things as well that Tatler always did very well was the kind of the special supplements that come with the magazine, either the travel or health and plastic
surgery. Yeah, no, we absolutely, I've inherited loads of supplements, you know, virtually with every issue. They're absolutely incredible. I spent a lot of time working on them. I think, you know, they sit around, you know, even longer perhaps than the main issue. So absolutely, the cosmetic surgery guide is really important. Well, I just got the job. Our brilliant health and beauty director, who I inherited, had done the supplement, and she gave a breakfast, which I attended at the Savoy. And all these doctors were coming up to me saying, Richard, we have to be in Tatler, because, you know, they have clients who get on planes from Dubai and Moscow and wherever, and they land at Heathrow and they get cars straight to Harley Street clutching Tatler. So it's the kind of Bible for that. But there are other really important strands. You know, the Tatler Schools Guide, which runs with the October issue. I mean, that's a very, very important thing for the kind of education industry in this country. And of course, people from all over the world look at schools and boarding schools here for their children. So that's really important. I think it's, you know, really the only kind of independent schools magazine of its kind, which has these sort of completely brilliant and honest reviews of what these schools are like. And, you know, when we launch it, it was amazing walking into the ballroom of this hotel in the West End, and it was just absolutely packed with headmasters and teachers from the most famous schools in the world, and they were sort of really excited to be part of it. So yeah.
Richard, I have a curiosity. I mean, you being the editor of Tatler, because of course you cover celebrities, high society, but sometimes I know you can be tongue-in-cheek with them as well, but how's your relationship with those people? Because sometimes, you know, they can be featured in a nice way, but sometimes there can be like a funny, a little bit snarky comment here and there. You have to be quite a lot of kind of skills to deal with everyone in a way.
Yeah, look, I definitely want Tatler to have a sense of humour. And, you know, in the current issue, the December issue, you know, we've got the party awards, and in it you've got kind of, you know, best party of the year, but you've also kind of got breakout socialite and these things. But, you know, it's done
with worst accident.
Exactly. But, you know, it's done with it's not unkind, you know, that those kind of things, you know, have a sense of humour. You know, I'd be very surprised if the people receiving those awards were kind of devastated by it, and I wouldn't want that at all. You know, Tatler's got this great history. I mean, really, when it started, it was a satirical magazine. So it was really the first kind of thing of its kind. When it was founded in 1709, it was covering the coffee houses of St. James's, and, you know, it was really writing in a way that had never been done before. In the early 18th century, it was a time of political unrest and the War of the Spanish Succession, and going towards the end of Queen Anne's reign. It was a sort of, London was this kind of real melting pot of, you know, politics and glamour and fashion. And Tatler was the first, it was a newspaper three times a week, and it was really the first kind of publication of its kind to write about those people and sort of really get the inside access that we still have now.
What can you say to us, I mean, for 2019? Do you have any plans, or just continue what you're doing?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, every issue kind of has its own kind of themes and sort of meanings. And the great thing for me was to be able to go to the kind of collections and see and do the shows and really now plan the season properly. So that's a nice thing to be able to do. We're working on the big fashion issues for next year. And, you know, I think there'll be some interesting political stories we can do. Obviously, you know, Brexit and all those kind of things. And there's always sort of interesting access we can get in the world of Westminster. So yeah, I think it's more of the same. I think what's really important is not to consider, you know, websites as a dumping ground for what doesn't work for print. I think different, you know, when we have features meetings and fashion meetings, we divide stuff up. It's not, one thing's not better than the other. They're just both incredible different ways of getting the content out.
That was Tatler's editor, Richard Denon, and the December issue of the magazine is out now. Now, Regular listeners to the programme might well recall the launch of issue one of Lindsay magazine out of Melbourne back in the spring of this year. The fruits of editor and creative director Beth Wilkinson, this rich cultural review takes its name from Beth's grandfather, Lindsay James Stanger, from whom she inherited her first camera. Well, Beth spoke to me earlier about her learnings on the road since, including here in London, both promoting issue one and reporting issue two. She talked about its launch at events in Melbourne and in New York City. And first, how to keep your momentum after making a successful debut.
There were different challenges with making the second issue, and it felt nice to finally have issue one out in the world. And you develop a certain confidence once that's out there. But at the same time, there was all these new stories to get and still so much to do. And I guess you also have a certain level of expectations. And I was really proud of what I had created with issue one. And so now I was like, I need to do that again. So those certain expectations that all of a sudden you have to meet.
Well, let's talk a little bit before we delve into the pages of issue two about the reception, I suppose, of the first issue. And I know that you've been over in Europe and you got to see the magazine in other environments, if you like, which must be very fun. But you're sitting in Melbourne, which is something of a hotbed, isn't it, of sort of independent magazines. There's lots of great innovation and creativity. How was Lindsay welcomed into that world? Did it receive the enthusiasm that you had been hoping? Did it even exceed that?
Yeah, I think it exceeded it, which is really nice. It's been very warmly welcomed, and especially here in Melbourne. It's a pretty small city here, so it's amazing how quickly word has spread about Lindsay in Melbourne. Yeah, we've been able to work with like really great partners, and we just had our issue one launch event in Melbourne just a couple of weeks ago, and we did that at one of my favourite spaces in Melbourne at Heidi Museum, and we did a talk there and the event sold out overnight. So there's been some really great opportunities, and I couldn't be really happier with what the reception's been like. But likewise, like you said, I was in Europe earlier this year, and that was just such an amazing experience to be able to go out there into the world and see it in stores. And especially in London, there was just such an amazing, you know, it must be so amazing for you guys to be there in London, because there is such a strong energy for publishing and especially printed matter. And I went to a talk. There was a talk on at Somerset House about the resurgence of print, and I met up with Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman. So yeah, there was just a lot of great opportunities in Europe.
Great people to meet. And yeah, Penny's a good friend of this programme. And I guess here at Monocle, you know, we obviously are passionate about print, but we also like to depict a certain kind of optimism, I suppose, in our pages and indeed on our airwaves. It's all about tracking down opportunities. And it's telling, isn't it, that I know Lindsay's MO is this idea of celebrating culture, celebrating place. And it's a very optimistic title. Was that something that you decided to sort of make explicit in that sort of almost mission statement? Or were you always confident that would sort of shine through in the pages because it's your editorial approach as well?
It's a really difficult thing, actually. And I didn't realize how difficult it would be until I started creating these stories. But my idea initially was that I wanted it to be this really celebratory magazine. And then as I started to create these pieces or work with contributors who, you know, were creating these pieces, you realize like every place obviously has its own history. And sometimes those histories can be quite dark. And I guess for Lindsay, it was really important. We don't want to like shy away from those things. Like we want to acknowledge them and we want to talk about them, but perhaps that's not necessarily the focus. So that's something that I've had to sort of, I guess, get my head around. And it changed from being celebrating culture and place to celebrating the importance of it. Because we're not always celebrating, I guess, everything about places. But in essence, the core of it is meant to be a focus on, you know, things that we want to celebrate and things that we want to give readers an opportunity to learn more about and appreciate.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about issue number two and your sort of cover features, Ryuichi Sakamoto, shot in New York. And I know, Beth, that you, I think you shot those, the beautiful portraits. Tell me a bit about that. You know, if you get an interview with someone like Ryuichi-san, you know, that, I guess, is the realization of, I don't know, a long-held ambition. It must be a real pleasure to get heroes and heroic people with amazing stories to tell and to get to speak to them or to shoot them and to feature them on your pages. Did that live up to its billing? some people say don't meet your heroes.
It was. No, it did. It was such an honour to photograph him. And I actually shot him in London when I was there, just before his show at the Barbican. And he's actually just arrived, funnily enough, in Melbourne tonight. He's about to play a couple of shows here in Melbourne. So I've just popped over and saw him before to get him to sign some copies of our issue with his photo on the cover. But yeah, no, he's such an amazing man. And he's also got a documentary out at the moment about his life. I'm not sure if you've seen that, but if you're curious about process and about musicality, then I think it's really worth seeing. But he's a fascinating man, and it was a true honor to have him on our cover of our second issue. And yeah, he was definitely someone that was on the top of our wish list from day dot. So yeah, exciting opportunity.
Indeed. Well, let me ask you about that wish list. And I don't want to, obviously, without prejudice to your forward planning meetings, of course, Lindsay. How does that work, Beth? Tell us a bit about that, you and your team. Is it a question of kind of pulling crazy ideas out of the hat? Do you have things that have been on the back burner that you're always constantly looking at, whether it's for this issue or indeed issues to come? What's that process like? Is it very collaborative? Do you get these sort of lightning bolts of inspiration? How does it work when you're coming up with ideas for the piece?
Pretty much I am the Lindsay team, and then obviously I work with different contributors from all over the world. So I sort of describe the editorial process as a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, as I'm sure it is for many publications. But because our subject is the world, which obviously has so many different topics and so many different places, to sort of have the best breadth of all of those different topics, it's really about, I guess, starting with a centerpiece. And sometimes that's our hero piece, or sometimes it's not, but then we build out from that. So then it's about, okay, now we've got enough content, you know, usually on America, for example, and then we start to go, well, we haven't covered this location, or we haven't done anything on food yet. And it sort of works its way out from there.
To that point about being kind of a bit of a sort of one-woman team, what about the sort of business side of things? Because I know that it's often questions about distribution or, you know, complex issues around publishing that sometimes wrong foot aspiring magazine editors, because there is this feeling, particularly in the independent space, that, you know, every editor almost needs to be a businessman or a businesswoman as well. Have you found that, and do you have a head for that, or is that sometimes a bit of a reach? And who do you consult? What are your frames of reference?
Yeah, I kind of like it, to be honest. I would say I'm quite a creative person, but I also really enjoy the strategic side of things. And I get pretty excited when I start drawing up a business plan, or, you know, thinking about ways that I can make this work. And I definitely meet with lots of different people all the time. That's something, you know, like I said before, I met with Penny, and I met with heaps of people when I was in Europe. And likewise here in Melbourne, I have like quite a few mentors that I regularly catch up with. I am also a photographer and a designer on the side, but Lindsay is, you know, takes up a good portion of my week. And I found it a really exciting process, I guess, to learn more about the publishing industry and how some people make it work and how others, I guess, find different ways to make it work. So as I'm sure you know from speaking to so many people and working in publishing yourself, it's a bit of an enigma, but I really believe that it's something that can work, and it is. It's working, like lots of publications are proving you can make it work. And I've sort of seen the same thing from my experience, I guess, that we started out online and then we all of a sudden started doing print. And as soon as we did that, the whole reception to Lindsay just changed. And, you know, I get these regular personal emails from our readers just talking about how much they connect with the magazine. And I think there is, at least on that sort of smaller independent scale, there's a real desire to have publications like Lindsay and all the other ones that are coming out at the moment.
Well, let's look to the future. I feel almost it's an inappropriate question almost with issue number two just hot off the presses almost, whether it's strategically, whether it's editorial ideas, where are you setting your sights next, Beth?
Well, I'm setting them on New York. So I'm leaving for New York in a few days, and we're having a launch on the 30th of October at McNally Jackson in Williamsburg, which is really exciting. I will do a little talk on self-publishing, and I've also got a couple of my contributors who will talk about their pieces. So from there, it's we're knee deep already in issue 3, and that'll come out in March. But as you know, it just one issue's out and then you're already working on the next.
It's an unforgiving schedule, isn't it? But hugely fulfilling, I guess. Well, look, best of luck in New York. Have a fabulous launch. And certainly next time you're passing through London, come and see us at Midori House, Beth. But thanks for chatting to us on The Stack today. Finally, on today's programme, we head to Brazil to hear from one of the most important voices in the country's editorial market, Daniela Falcao, Managing Director for Edição Globo Condé Nast, a joint venture between the respected Brazilian publishing company Editora Globo and Condé Nast. They're responsible for Vogue Brazil, GQ Brazil, Casa Vogue and Glamour. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Daniela in her office in the heart of São Paulo. Daniela began by talking about the history of Vogue Brazil.
Vogue Brazil is a very old magazine. People don't know or don't realize that so much. It has 43 years in Brazil. It was one of the first Vogues outside Europe and the US, of course. When I joined in 2005, it was a very well-known magazine, considered a luxury magazine, but it didn't talk to women, really. And it was funny because it was mostly directed by men. The editor-in-chief was a man. The art director was a man. The fashion editor was a man. So it was a very quality magazine, but it was not hot for women. So I think the interesting, or what I could brought when I first arrived, was the sense of news or what's hot. Information that it's needed for women without losing all the glamour and the allure that Vogue had. So I think my first years in Vogue, the challenge was to make it newsworthy. So it's not only a very pretty magazine with incredible fashion and models, but it also had something that women would use in their daily lives. Trends, or how to wear trends in your daily life, all the news in beauty, but really thinking or focus on how the reader could apply this to their daily routine, which I think is, if you don't do this now, I mean, you just lose relevance. So you have to be something either that you would discuss with friends in a bar or something that you would use in your personal life. So this is the mix that I believe for journalism.
How would you compare the Brazilian Vogue with other Vogues? I mean, is it very much for a Brazilian woman, perhaps living in the big centers like São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro?
Yeah, we discussed this a lot because there is a common DNA for all Vogues. You know, is this woman that she can afford, she has the information, she's very secure about herself. So this is, I think, is the common DNA. But then it changes a lot from country to country. We have done focus group studies and we try to discuss and see what makes Brazilian Vogue different. It's very Brazilian and it reflects in the magazine. So German Vogue is very German also, in my opinion. It's not that, because that's a stereotype. It's not that the woman is sad, but she's more intense and closed, while we, you know, fashion photographers, they hate to have models smiling. And in Brazil, we always try to do this because otherwise it would just not connect to the reader. So the Joie de Vivre is the first thing. I think it's a very action-oriented magazine. So in the covers and in the fashion editorials, women are always in action because that's also Brazil. And it's colorful, of course, and voluptuous, because Brazilian women are like this. So we have, for example, now Condé Nast, they only use models 18 and older on their covers. But for us, and this was a decision 2 years ago, when there was a whole movement in the industry to take care of the models, so try to avoid as much as possible using models who are under 18. Now it's a law. In the beginning, it was under 16. Now it's under 18. We always prefer models who already were moms. So they have passed through the pregnancy. They have bodies, even if they're perfect, but they are bodies you can relate closer than a very young model. So there was always not necessarily the model that the fashion world loved most at the moment. So it was not the it girl, but it was real women who were there for a long time. So also, I think there is this earthy thing about Brazilian Vogue that sometimes is different from others that are more avant-garde, like Italian Vogue, that it's amazing. But we have more a sense of reality than they do. They are experts in having this dream after so many years of Franca Sozzani. So each magazine carries the story of the country and the story of the magazine in the country. And those are the aspects I think are more different.
And Daniela, now you're also responsible for other titles as well. And I have to say, just walking around Brazil, every good news agent has your magazines featured prominently. I know Brazil is going through a recession. Is it quite difficult, I guess, to publish magazines in this market? Did it affect your magazines, or how are you dealing with that?
I think that the crisis in print is not a Brazilian crisis. It's a global crisis. And what we have learned so far is that not all magazines necessarily are going to survive in print. That's why we try not to even use the name magazine. We don't use anymore. They are brands. And editor-in-chiefs, they are not editor-in-chiefs anymore. They are content directors. Because if you are in a workshop, or if you're in an event with a brand, or if you're in Instagram, you're producing content all the time for the magazine. In that sense, I think what Global Condé Nast did very well was to try to engage in all these other formats of communication, meaning events, what we call live, but it's the live experience, and using digital in all possible ways. You know, there's a lot of trying. You have to see which, for example, social networks adapt best to your audience. It's not the truth for Casa Vogue. It's definitely not the same truth for Glamour. So you have to experience and see how it goes. So I think that the global crisis of print, it's something that we are learning by experience. And again, Glamour, for example, in many countries, it's not a monthly magazine anymore, or it's not even existing in print, or only one edition a year or two editions a year. It's a title that talks a lot to millennials. It's a younger audience, so it makes sense to be mostly digital. Vogue, on the other hand, that it's a luxury magazine, almost a coffee table book, it makes sense to be in print. And it's curious because you see Vogue, the circulation has been quite stable. Glamour, on the other hand, used to have a much higher circulation than Vogue. Now it's more or less like Vogue. And of course, we try to follow and see how it goes. I cannot say how it's going to be in 4 years, but I like to be in this moment of disruption in which you have to pay attention in everything. And the good thing is that you can try and then go back if it doesn't necessarily work. But the crisis in Brazil, it's much more a financial crisis. So we used to have a very strong national fashion industry, and that industry has collapsed. So now we depend much more on international advertisers. So far, we are doing fine. It's much harder, you know, to get the numbers in terms of revenue that we used to. You have to either do branded content or events. Advertising per se is not coming in the same flow that it used to. So yes, it affects us. We have not had any big layoffs or anything like this. But every month is a struggle, I won't lie. With the current political situation in which no one is sure if the next president will be able to carry on the reforms that are needed, it means on the best case scenario that 2019 is going to be as bad as 2018. And that's the best case scenario. So it's a challenge, but I think Brazilians have become resilient. And maybe not all magazines will survive, but I think that the big loss has already happened. So those fashion brands that either closed or decided that they could not have any investment in marketing at all, this already happened. So I think we are in the middle of the storm, but our boat is in good conditions.
That's excellent news. And Daniela, just one final question. I'm a big fan of Casa Vogue. I mean, if you don't mind saying a few words, I think, you know, you're talking about, you know, Brazilian women, but I think such a Brazilian magazine for design, it's amazing. I'm a big fan. Tell us a bit more about that title.
It is a decoration and architecture magazine, but it's also a lifestyle magazine. And in that sense, it also has a lot of Brazilian-ness in its page in a very elegant way, but original too. I think it's a magazine that goes more in depth on the Brazilian roots of everything, because it can. It has a lot of space for photography. We cover art a lot, and we always try to bring Brazilian design, and Brazil is very good in design. I think Brazil, it's much more important in the architecture and design world, for the world, than in fashion. In fashion, we're new. We're just experimenting. Besides beachwear, it's not that we're relevant for the world. But if you see Niemeyer, Lúcio Costa, Sérgio Rodrigues, Irmãos Campana, there are so many amazing names in Brazilian design and architecture that are known and important and relevant in art too. So Casa Vogue has this advantage of being a lifestyle and a niche publication in a niche in which Brazil is something that makes us very proud.
Daniela Falcao, Managing Director for Edições Globo Condé Nast. That's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. As always, write to Fernando. You can find him on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the very same time next weekend. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.